and to whip past the opening, lit by the rapid flashes, and the rhythms in her head went crazy, breaking apart, movements of one melding with another. The ground trembled and groaned, and Venli sought to hide deeper in the building, away from the violence. As she passed a doorway, however, the floor undulated, and she was cast to the ground. With a sound so loud, her whole body vibrated, an entire section of the stone building was ripped free, including the room she'd just left. She was pelted by rain, exposed to the howling winds through the broken wall. This was the end of the world. Tiny, terrified, she pressed herself between two solid-seeming chunks of rock and closed her eyes, unable to hear the rhythms over the sound of the tempest. She knew what rhythm she'd hear if she could, though. For there, pressed between stones, Venli was forced to admit what she really was. The truth that had always been there, covered over, encrusted with creme, exposed only when the winds cut her to her soul. She was no genius, forging a new path for her people. Everything she'd discovered had been given or hinted at by Ulim. She was no queen deserving of rule. She cared nothing for her people, just for her own self. She wasn't powerful. The winds and the storm reminded her that no matter what she did, no matter how hard she tried, no matter how much she pretended, she would always be small. She had pretended she was those things, and would likely pretend them again as soon as she could lie to herself, as soon as she was safe. But here, with everything else flayed away and her soul stripped bare, Venli was forced to admit what she truly was, what she'd always been, a coward. 96. A Thousand Lies.
I tell you, I write it. You must release the captive unmade. She will not fade as I will. If you leave her as she is, she will remain imprisoned for eternity.
Relaine found her crying. Venli could count on her fingers the number of times she could remember crying. Not merely attuning mourning, but actually crying. Today she couldn't help herself. She knelt in the sectioned-off part of the infirmary room, overlooking the large map of the shattered plains that Relaine had stolen. She was alone. Lirin and Hesina were in the main room, seeing to the patients. A note on the map hinted at what Raboniel had said. A group of nomads in the hills. Her people. They had survived. She turned to Relaine, who, shocked, was humming to awe at finding her like this.
"We're not the last," Venli whispered. "They are alive, Relaine. Thousands of them."
"Who?" He knelt. "What are you talking about?" Venli wiped her eyes. She wouldn't have her tears destroying this glorious map. Venli handed him the note Raboniel had given her, but of course he couldn't read, so she read it out loud for him.
"You mean,"
he said, attuning awe,
"thousands of them?"
"It was Thud," Venli said. "He refused storm form. So did most of Eshonai's closest friends. I wasn't thinking back then. I would have had them killed, but Eshonai separated them off and let them escape. Part of her fought, so she gave them a chance, and then..."
Storms. She was a mess. She wiped her eyes again.
"You would have had them killed?"
Relaine said.
"Venli, I don't understand. What is it you're not telling me?"
"Everything," she whispered to pleading. "A thousand lies, Relaine."
"Venli," he said, taking her hand. "Kaladin is awake. Teft is too. We have a plan. The start of one, at least. I came to explain it to Lirin and Hesina. We're going to try to wake the Radiance, but we need to get those storm forms out of the room. If you know something that might help, now would be a good time to talk.
Help? Venli whispered. Nothing I do helps. It only hurts.
Relaine hummed to confusion. At a gentle prompting from Timber, Venli started talking. She began with the strange human woman who had given her the sphere, and went all the way up to when Thude and the others left. She didn't hide her part in it. She didn't coat it with the rhythm of consolation. She gave it to him raw, the whole terrible story. As she spoke, he pulled farther and farther away from her. His expression changed, his eyes widening, his rhythms moving from shocked to angry, as she might have expected, as she wanted. When she finished, they sat in silence.
You are a monster, he finally said. You did this. You are responsible.
She hummed to consolation.
I suppose the enemy would have found another way, he said, without your help. Regardless, Venli,
I need to find them, she said, rolling up the map. There are daily transfers to Kolinar. Raboniel has released me from my duties here and given me a writ allowing me to requisition whatever I need. I should be able to procure a spot in the next transfer and from there go with some heavenly ones on a scouting mission out to the Shattered Plains.
And in so doing, you'd lead the enemy directly to our people, Relaine said. Venli, Raboniel obviously wants you to do this. She knows you're going to run to them. You're playing into whatever plot she has.
She'd considered that. She wasn't exactly in the most rational state of mind, however.
I have to do something, Relaine, she whispered. I need to see them with my own eyes, even if I have to walk there.
I agree. We should do that as soon as it's reasonable, Relaine said.
He glanced toward the curtains, then spoke more quietly.
But now isn't the time. We have to save the Radiance.
Do you really want me there when you do, Relaine? Do you want me around?
He fell silent, then hummed to betrayal.
Smart, she said.
I don't want you around right now, Venli, he said. But Storm Me, we need you, and I think you're trustworthy. You told me this, after all. And who knows how much of what you did was influenced by your forms, or those Voidspren. For now, let's work on saving the Radiance. If you're truly sorry for what you did, then this is the best way to prove it. After that, we can seek out our people without leading the Fused to them.
She looked away, then hummed to betrayal herself.
No, this isn't my fight, Relaine. It never was. I have to go see if this map is true. I have to.
Fine, he snapped.
He stood to leave, then paused.
You know, all those months running bridges, then training with Cal and the others. I wondered deep down if I was a traitor. I now realize I didn't have the first notes of understanding what it meant to be a traitor.
He ducked out between the curtains. Venli quietly tucked the map of the Shattered Plains into its case, then put it under her arm. It was time for her to go. She found both Dull and Mazish caring for the fallen Radiance. Venli pulled them aside and whispered,
"The time has come. Are we ready to leave?"
Finally, Dull said to excitement. We've siphoned away rations, canteens of water, blankets, and some extra clothing from what we were given to care for the Radiance. Harrel has it all ready in packs, hidden among the other supplies in the storage room we were given.
The people are ready, Mazish said. Eager. We think we can survive in the cold up here for months.
We'll need those supplies, Venli said. But we might not have to survive in the mountains.
Look.
She showed them the writ of authority Raboniel had given her.
With this we can get through the oath gates. No questions asked.
Maybe, Dol said to appreciation. So we go to Kolinar, but then what? We're back where we began.
We take the supplies, and we use this writ to leave the city, Venli explained. We hike out to the east and disappear into the wilderness to the east of Alethkar, like my ancestors did so many generations ago.
Then we make our way to the Shattered Plains, she thought.
But that would take too long. Could Venli find a way to scout ahead, using the aid of the Heavenly Ones? Perhaps get dropped off nearer the unclaimed hills without revealing what she was truly seeking? It seemed a lot to demand of this one writ. Plus, Raboniel knew about the listeners who had survived. Surely she'd eventually tell the other fused. For the moment, Venli didn't care.
Gather the others, she whispered. The humans are going to attempt to rescue the Radiants here soon. The chaos should cover our escape. I want us to leave in the next day or two.
The other two attuned resolve. They trusted her. More than she trusted herself. Venli doubted she would find redemption among the listeners who had escaped the fused. In fact, she expected accusation, condemnation. But Venli had to try to reach them. For when they'd escaped, they'd taken her mother with them. Jaxlem might be dead, and if not, her mind would still be lost to age. But she was also the last person, the only person, who might still love Venli, despite it all. 97. Freedom.
As one who has suffered for so many centuries, as one whom it broke, please find Mishram and release her, not just for her own good, for the good of all Spren. For I believe that in confining her, we have caused a greater wound to Roshar than any ever realized.
Navani entered a feverish kind of study, a frantic near madness, as the work consumed her. Before, she had organized. Now, she merely fed the beast. She barely slept. The answer was here. The answer meant something. She couldn't explain why, but she needed this secret. Food became a distraction. Time stopped mattering. She put her clocks away so they wouldn't remind her of human constructs like minutes and hours. She was searching for something deeper, more important. These actions horrified a part of her. She was still herself, the type of woman who put her socks in the drawer so they all faced the same direction. She loved patterns. She loved order. But in this quest for meaning, she found she could appreciate something else entirely. The raw, disorganized chaos of a brain making connections paired with the single-minded order of a quest for one all-consuming answer. Could she find the opposite to Voidlight? Stormlight and Voidlight had their own kind of polarity. They were attracted to tones like iron shavings to a magnet. Therefore, she needed a tone that would push light away. She needed an opposite sound. She wanted fluid tones, so she had a slide whistle delivered, along with a brass horn with a movable tube. However, she liked the sound of the plates best. They were difficult to increment, but she could order new ones cut and crafted quickly. Her study morphed from music theory, where some philosophers said that the true opposite of sound was silence, to mathematics. Mathematics taught that there were numbers associated with tones, frequencies, wavelengths. Music, at its most fundamental level, was math. She played the tone that represented the sound of Voidlight again and again, embedding it into her mind. She dreamed it when she slept. She played it first thing when she arose, watching the patterns of sand it made on a metal plate. Dancing grains, bouncing up and down, settling into peaks and troughs. The opposite of most numbers was a negative number. Could a tone be negative? Could there be a negative wavelength? Many such ideas couldn't exist in the real world,
like negative numbers were an artificial construct. But those peaks and troughs, could she make a tone that produced the opposite pattern? Peaks where there were troughs, troughs where there were peaks? During her feverish study into sound theory, she discovered the answer to this. A wave could be negated, its opposite created and presented in a way that nullified the original, cancelling it out. They called it destructive interference. Strangely, the theory said that a sound and its opposite sounded exactly the same. This stumped her. She played the plates she'd created, indulging in their resonant tones. She put void-light spheres into her arm sheath and listened until she could hum that tone. She was delighted when, after hours of concerted practice, she could draw void-light out with a touch, like the fused could do. Humans could sing the correct tones. Humans could hear the music of Roshar. Her ancestors might have been aliens to this world, but she was its child. That didn't solve the question, though. If a tone and its destructive interference sounded the same, how could she sing one and not the other? She played the tone on a plate, humming along. She next played a tuning fork, listened to the tones of the gemstones, then came back to the plate. It was wrong, barely off, even though the tones matched. She asked for and was given a file. She tried to measure the notes the plate made, but eventually had to rely on her own ear. She worked on the plate, filing off small sections of the metal and then pulling the bow across it, getting the plate closer and closer. She could hear the tone she wanted, she thought. Or was it madness, this desire to create an anti-sound? It took hours, maybe days. When it finally happened, she knelt bleary-eyed on the stone floor at some unholy hour, holding a bow, testing her newest version of the plate. When she played this particular tone, bow on steel, something happened. Void light was shoved out of the sphere attached to the plate. It was pushed away from the source of the sound. She tested it again, then a third time to be sure. Though she should have wanted to shout for joy, she simply sat there staring. She ran her hand through her hair, which she hadn't put up today. Then she laughed. It worked. The next day, washed and feeling slightly less insane, Navani incremented. She tested how loud the tone needed to be to produce the desired effect. She measured the tone on different sizes of gemstones and on a stream of void light, leaving a sphere to flow toward a tuning fork. She did all of this in a way that, best she could, hid what she was doing from her watching guard. Hunched over her workspace, she was relatively certain the regal there wouldn't be able to tell she'd made a breakthrough. The one last night hadn't watched keenly. He'd been dozing through much of it. Confident that her tone worked, she began training herself to hum the tone the plate made. It did sound the same, but somehow it wasn't the same. As when measuring spren, which reacted to your thoughts about them, this tone needed intent to be created. You had to know what you were trying to do. Incredibly, it mattered that she wanted to hum the opposite tone to Odium's song. It sounded crazy, but it worked. It was repeatable and quantifiable. Inside the madness of these last few days, science still worked. She had found Voidlight's opposite tone. But how could she create light that expressed this tone? For answers, she looked to nature. A magnet could be made to change its polarity with some captive lightning, and another magnet could realign the pole. But Raboniel had mentioned they could magnetize an ordinary piece of metal that way too. So were they really changing the polarity of the magnet? Or were they blanking the existing polarity, then rewriting it with something new? The idea intrigued her, and she made a few key requests of her jailers, some objects that would have to be fetched from one of the labs near the top of the tower. Soon after, Raboniel came to check on her. Navani braced herself. She'd been planning for this.
Navani? The fused asked. This latest request is quite odd. I don't know what to make of it.
It's just some esoteric lab equipment, Navani said from the desk. Nothing of any real note, though it would be fun to use in some experiments. No bother if you can't find it.
I authorized the request, Raboniel said. If it is there, you shall have it.
That was a rhythm to express curiosity. She made a note in her book. She was trying to list them all.
What are you working on? Raboniel asked. The guard tells me of a terrible sound you have been making, something discordant.
Damnation. The new tone didn't sound the same to a regal. Could she explain it away? I'm testing how atonal sounds influence void light, if at all.
Raboniel lingered, looking over Navani's shoulder. Then she glanced at the floor, where a bucket of icy water with snow from outside held a submerged gemstone. It was an attempt to see if temperature could blank the tone of void light.
What are you not telling me? Raboniel said to a musing rhythm. I find your behavior intriguing.
She glanced to the side as her daughter trailed into the room. The younger fused was drooling today. Raboniel had a servant periodically put a cloth against the side of her daughter's mouth. It wasn't that her face was paralyzed, more that she didn't seem to notice or care that she was drooling.
You write about something called Axie in our notebook, Navani said, trying to distract Raboniel. What are these?
An axon is the smallest division of matter, Raboniel said. Odium can see them. Theoretically, with a microscope powerful enough, we could see little balls of matter making up everything.
Navani had read many theories about such a smallest division of matter. It spoke to her state of mind that she barely considered it a curiosity to have such theories confirmed by a divine source. Do these axi have a polarity? Navani asked, as she monitored the temperature of her experiment.
They must, Raboniel said. We theorize that axial interconnection is what holds things together. Certain surges influence this. The forces between axi are fundamental to the way the cosmere works.
Navani grunted, writing another notation from the thermometer.
What are you doing? Raboniel asked.
Seeing if a colder temperature changes the vibrations in a gemstone, Navani admitted. Would you hold this one and tell me if the rhythm changes or grows louder as it warms up?
I can do that, Raboniel said, settling down on the floor beside the desk.
Behind, her daughter mimicked her. The attendant, a singer in work form, knelt to dab at the daughter's lips. Navani took the gemstone out with a pair of tongs and gave it to Raboniel. Though Navani could faintly hear the tones of gemstones if she pressed a lot of them to her skin, her skill wasn't fine-tuned enough to detect small changes in volume. She needed a singer to finish this experiment. But how to keep Raboniel from figuring out what she'd discovered?
Raboniel took the sphere and waited, her eyes closed. Finally, she shook her head.
I can sense no change in the tone. Why does it matter?
I'm trying to determine if anything alters the tone, Navani said. Creating warlight requires a slight alteration of Odium's and Honor's tones in order to put them into harmony. If I can find other things that alter Voidlight's tone, I might be able to create other hybrids.
It was a plausible enough explanation. It should explain her requests for plates and other devices, even the ice.
A novel line of reasoning, Raboniel said to her curiosity rhythm.
I had not thought you would take notice, Navani said. I assumed you were busy with your work on making the sibling. I still need to bring down the final node, Raboniel said. Last time I touched the sibling, I thought I could sense it somewhere nearby, but it is very, very small, smaller than the others. She rose from the floor. Let me know if you require further equipment. Thank you, Navani said from her desk. Raboniel lingered as Navani recorded her notes about the ice water experiment. Navani managed to appear unconcerned, right until she heard the plates being shifted. She turned to see Raboniel pulling out the new one, the one she'd hidden beneath several others. Damnation! How had she picked out that one? Perhaps it showed the most use. Raboniel looked to Navani, who forced herself to turn away as if it were nothing. Then Raboniel played it. Navani breathed out quietly, closing her eyes. She'd racked her mind for ways to hide what she was doing, taking every precaution she could. But she should have known. She was at such a severe disadvantage, watched at all times, with Raboniel always nearby. Navani opened her eyes and found Raboniel staring wide-eyed at the plate. She placed a sphere of void light and played again, watching the light eject from the sphere. Raboniel spoke to a reverential rhythm. A tone that forces out void light? Navani kept her face impassive. Well, that answered one question. She'd wondered if the person playing the note needed the proper intent to eject the void light, but it seemed that creating the plate to align to her hummed tones was enough. Navani, Raboniel said, lowering the bow. This is remarkable and dangerous. I felt the void light in my gem heart respond. It wasn't ejected, but my very soul cringed at the sound. I'm shocked and befuddled. How did you create this?
Math, Navani admitted. And inspiration.
This could lead to... Raboniel hummed to herself, then glanced at the bucket of ice water. You're trying to find a way to dampen the vibrations of the void light so you can rewrite it with a different tone. A different polarity. That's why you asked about Axie.
She hummed to an excited rhythm, and damnation if a part of Navani wasn't caught up in that sound, in the thrill of discovery, of being so close. Careful, Navani, she reminded herself. She had to do her best to keep this knowledge from the enemy. There was a way, a plan she'd been making, should Raboniel intrude as she had. A possible path to maintaining the secrets of anti-void light. For now, she needed to seem amenable.
Yes, Navani said. I think what you wanted all along is possible, Raboniel. I have reason to believe there is an opposite light to void light.
Have you written this down?
No, I've merely been toying with random ideas.
A lie you must tell, Raboniel said. I do not begrudge you it, Navani. But know that I will rip this room apart to find your notes, if I must.
Navani remained quiet, meeting Raboniel's gaze.
Still, you do not believe me, Raboniel said, that we are so much stronger when working together.
How could I trust your word, Raboniel? Navani said. You've already broken promises to me, and each time I've asked to negotiate for the benefit of my people or the sibling, you've refused.
Yes? But haven't I led you to a weapon? She asked. Haven't I given you the secrets you needed to make it this far? Within reach of something that could kill a god? All because we worked together.
Let's take this last step as one.
Navani debated. She knew that Raboniel wasn't lying. The Fused would rip this room apart to find Navani's notes. Beyond that, she'd likely take away Navani's ability to requisition supplies, halting her progress. And she was so close. With a sigh, Navani crossed the room and took her notebook, the one they'd named Rhythm of War, from a hidden spot under one of the shelves. Perhaps Navani should have kept all of her discoveries in her head, but she'd been unable to resist writing them down. She'd needed to see her ideas on the page, to use notes, to get as far as she had. Raboniel settled in to read, to learn what Navani had discovered about this new tone, humming a rhythm of curiosity to herself. A short time later, a servant arrived at the door carrying a large wooden box. At last. Navani stepped over, taking the box from the servant. Inside was a glass tube, a little less than a foot in diameter, though it was several feet long, with thick metal caps on the ends.
And that is? Raboniel asked.
A Thalen vacuum tube, Navani said. From the Royal Institute of Barometric Studies. We had this device near the top floor of the tower, where we were doing weather experiments. She set the device down and took the notebook back from Raboniel, making a few notations to start her next experiment. The metal caps could be unscrewed to reveal chambers that, with the seals in place, wouldn't disturb the vacuum in the central glass chamber. She opened one end, then affixed an empty diamond into it. Next, she used her jeweler's hammer to crack a gem full of void light, which made it start to leak. She quickly affixed it into the berth on the other side of the vacuum tube. She redid the ends, then used a Fabril pump to remove the air from the side chambers. Finally, she undid the clasps that sealed the side berths, opening them to the central vacuum. If she'd done everything correctly, little to no air would enter the central glass chamber, and she now had a gemstone on either end. Raboniel loomed over Navani as she observed the void light floating out into the vacuum. It didn't act as air would have. It wasn't pulled out, for example. Whatever void light was, it didn't seem to be made up of Axie. It was an energy, a power.
What are we doing? Raboniel asked softly.
I believe this is the only way to completely separate void light from the songs of Roshar, Navani explained. There can be no sound in a vacuum, as there is no air to transfer the waves. So, as this gemstone ejects void light, I'm hoping the light will not be able to hear Odium's rhythm for the first time in its existence.
You think it doesn't emit the rhythm itself, Raboniel said, but echoes it, picks it up.
Like Spren pick up mannerisms from humans, Navani said, or how a piece of metal can be magnetized by touching a magnet over a long period of time.
Ingenious, Raboniel whispered.
We'll see, Navani said. She grabbed her bow, then pressed the plate against the side of the vacuum chamber and began playing her anti-void light tone. Raboniel winced at the sound.
The light won't be able to hear, she said. It's in a vacuum, as you said.
Yes, but it's moving across and will soon touch the empty diamond at the other side, Navani said. I want this to be the first thing it hears when it touches matter. They had to wait a good while as the void light drifted in the vacuum, but Navani kept playing. In a way, this was the culmination of her days of fervor, the climax to the symphony of madness she'd been composing. Void light eventually touched the empty diamond and was pulled inside. She waited until a good measure of it had been drawn in, then had Raboniel undo the clasp separating the diamond's enclosure from the vacuum. Navani opened this to a little pop of sound, then plucked out the diamond. It glowed faintly violet black. She stared at it, looking closer until... Yes. A faint warping of the air around it. She felt a thrill as she handed it to Raboniel, who screamed. Navani caught the diamond as Raboniel dropped it. The fused pulled her hand to her breast, humming violently. I take it the sound wasn't pleasant, Navani said. It was like the tone that plate makes, Raboniel said, but 1,000 times worse. This is a wrongness, a vibration that should not exist. It sounds exactly the same as the tone of odium to me, Navani said. She set the gemstone on her desk, beside the dagger Raboniel had given her, the one that could channel and move light. Navani sat in the chair beside it. Raboniel joined her, moving a stool from beside the wall. Together, both of them stared at the little gemstone that seemed so wrong. Navani, Raboniel said. This changes the world. I know, Navani said. She rubbed her forehead, sighing. You look exhausted, Raboniel noted. I've barely slept for days, Navani admitted. Honestly, this is all so overwhelming. I need a break, Raboniel. To walk, to think, to gather my wits and get my blood moving again. Go ahead, Raboniel said. I'll wait. She waved for the guard to go with Navani, though the fused herself continued staring at the gemstone. In fact, Raboniel was so fixated on the diamond that she didn't notice Navani take rhythm of war as she stepped out with the guard into the hallway. She braced herself, expecting an explosion. It shook the corridor, striking with such physical force that Navani's guard jumped in shock. They both spun around to see smoke spewing from the room they'd left. The guard rushed back, grabbing Navani by the arm and hauling her along. They found chaos. The desk had exploded, and Raboniel lay on the floor. The fused's face was a mask of pain, and her front had been shredded, her hava ripped apart. The carapace scored and broken, the skin at her joints stuck with pieces of glass. Or diamond? She hadn't taken much shrapnel to the head, fortunately for her, though orange blood seeped from 1,000 little wounds on her arms and chest. At any rate, Raboniel was still alive, and Navani's scheme had failed. Navani had assumed that, in her absence, Raboniel would take the next step, to try mixing void light with the new light. Raboniel kept saying she expected the lights to puff away when mixed, vanishing. She didn't expect the explosion. Navani had hoped that if she died, it would delay Raboniel's corruption of the tower long enough for Navani to properly weaponize this new light. That was not to be. The explosion had been smaller than the one that had destroyed the room with the scholars, and Raboniel was far tougher than a human. A treasonous part of Navani was glad the fused had not died. Raboniel sat up, then surveyed the room. Several of the bookshelves had collapsed, spilling their contents. Raboniel's daughter was still sitting where she'd been, as if she hadn't even noticed what had happened, despite the fact that she bore cuts on her face. Her attendant appeared to be dead, lying slumped on the ground, face down. Navani felt a spike of legitimate sorrow for that. What did you do? Navani said. Lady of Wishes, what happened? Raboniel blinked as she stood. I put the diamond we created into the hilt of the dagger. Then use the tip to draw void light from another gemstone to mix them. It seemed the best way to see if the two lights would cancel one another out. I thought the reaction would be calm, like hot and cold water mixing.
Hot and cold water don't immediately annihilate one another when they meet, Navani said. Besides, heat under pressure, like light in a gemstone, is another matter.
Yes, Raboniel said, blinking several times, seeming dazed.
If you use the lightning of a storm form to ignite something under pressure, it always explodes. Perhaps if void light and anti-void light meet in open air, you'd get no more than a pop. But these were inside a gemstone. I have acted with supreme stupidity. Other fused, deepest ones, melded in through the walls to see what had happened. Raboniel waved them all off as her cuts healed under the power of her internal void light. The deepest ones took the servant, who fortunately stirred as they carried him. The desk was broken, the wall marked by a black scar. Navani smelled smoke. Bits of desk still burned. So the explosion had involved heat, not pressure alone. Raboniel shooed away the guard and the other fused, then picked through the rubble of the desk.
No remnants of the dagger, Raboniel said. Another embarrassment I must suffer, losing such a valuable weapon. I have others, but I'll need to eventually move you out of this room and have it scrubbed for every scrap of razium. We might be able to melt it down and reforge the dagger.
Navani nodded. For now, Raboniel said, I would like you to make me another gemstone filled with that anti-void light.
Now? Navani asked.
If you please.
Don't you want to change? Navani asked. Have someone pick the shards of glass out of your skin?
No, Raboniel said. I wish to see this process again. If you please, Navani.
It was said to a rhythm that indicated it would happen, regardless of what Navani pleased. So she prepared the vacuum chamber. It had been behind Raboniel, sheltered from the brunt of the blast, fortunately. As Navani worked, Raboniel sent someone for another herald-killing dagger. Why did she need that? Surely they weren't going to mix the lights after what had happened. Feeling an ominous cloud hanging over her, Navani repeated her experiment, this time filling the gemstone a little less, just in case, before removing it and holding it up. Raboniel took it, and though she didn't drop it this time, she did flinch.
So strange, she said.
She fitted it into her second dagger. Then she undid a screw and slipped out the piece of metal running through the center. She flipped it around. It had points on both ends and a hole for the screw before replacing it.
To make the anti-void light flow out of the gemstone along the blade?
Navani asked.
Instead of drawing in what it touches?
Indeed, Raboniel said. You may wish to take cover. Then she turned, walked across the room, and stabbed her daughter in the chest.
Navani was too stunned to move. She stood there amid the rubble, gaping as Raboniel loomed over the other fused, pushing the weapon in deeper. The younger fused began to spasm. And Raboniel held her, ruthless, as she pressed the weapon into her daughter's flesh. There was no explosion. The void light inside the fused wasn't under pressure, as it was in a gemstone, perhaps. There was a stench of burning flesh, and the skin blistered around the wound. The younger fused trembled and screamed, clutching at her mother's arm with a clawed hand. Then her eyes turned milky. Like white marble. She went limp, and Navani thought she saw something escape her lips. Smoke? As if her entire insides had been burned away. Raboniel pulled the dagger out, then tossed it away like a piece of rubbish. She cradled her daughter's body, pressing her forehead against that of the corpse, holding it close and rocking back and forth. Navani walked over, listening to Raboniel's sorrowful rhythm. though Raboniel's top knot of hair spilled around her face, Navani saw tears slipping down her red and black cheeks. Navani wasn't certain she'd ever seen a singer cry before. This was not ruthlessness at all. This was something else.
"You killed her," Navani whispered.
Raboniel continued to rock the corpse, holding it tighter, shaking as she hummed.
"Elisana Thile,"
Navani said, whispering the tenth name of the Almighty.
"You killed her forever, didn't you?"
"No more rebirth,"
Raboniel whispered.
"No more returns. Free at last, my baby. Free."
Navani pulled her hand up to her chest.
That pain, she knew that pain. It was how she'd felt hearing of Elokar's death at the hands of the Bridgeman traitor.
Raboniel had done this killing, though, performed it herself. But had the actual death happened long ago, centuries ago? What had it been like, living with a child whose body constantly returned to life, long after her mind had left her?
"This is why," Navani said, kneeling beside the two.
"Your god hinted that anti-void light was possible, and you suspected what it could do. You captured the tower, you imprisoned and pushed me, and possibly delayed the corruption of the sibling, because you hoped to find this anti-void light, not because you wanted a weapon against Odium, because you wanted to show a mercy to your daughter.
We could never create enough of this anti-light to threaten Odium," Raboniel whispered. "That was another lie, Navani. I'm sorry, but you took my dream and you fulfilled it. After I had given up on it, you persisted. One might think the immortal being would be the one to continue pursuing an idea to its end, but it was you."
Navani knelt with her hands in her lap, feeling like she'd witnessed something too intimate. So she gave Raboniel time to grieve.
Fused. Grieved. The immortal destroyers. The mythical enemies of all life. Grieved.
Raboniel's grief looked identical to that of a human mother who had lost her child. Eventually, Raboniel rested the body on the ground, then covered up the wound with a cloth from her pocket. She wiped her eyes and stood, calling for the guard to bring her some servants.
"What now?" Navani asked her. "Now I make sure this death was truly permanent," Raboniel said, "by communicating with the souls on Braes. If Esu has indeed died a final death, then we'll know you and I have achieved our goal. And..." She trailed off, then hummed a rhythm. "What?" Navani asked.
"Our notebook."
Raboniel looked toward where it sat on the floor. Navani had placed it there while creating the second anti-void light gemstone. Raboniel hummed a different rhythm as servants entered, and she gave terse orders. She sent some to burn her daughter's corpse and send honors and the ashes to the family that had donated the body to her daughter. She had others gather the vacuum tube and metal plates from Navani's experiments. Navani stepped forward to stop them, but Raboniel prevented her with a calm but firm hand. The fuse took the notebook from Navani's fingers.
"I will have a copy made for you," she promised Navani. "For now, I need this one to reconstruct your work."
"You saw how I did this, Raboniel."
"Yes, but I need to create a new plate, a new tone, for Stormlight."
Navani tried to pull free, but Raboniel's hold was firm. She hummed a dangerous rhythm, making Navani meet her eyes. Eyes that had been weeping were now firm and unyielding.
"So much for your words about working together," Navani said. "And you dared imply I was wrong to keep trying to hide things from you."
"I will end the war," Raboniel said. "That is the promise I will keep. For today we have discovered the means, finally. A way to make certain that the Radiants can no longer fight. They function as fused, do you see? If we kill the human, another Radiant will be born. The fight becomes eternal, both sides immortal. Today we end that. I have preserved the Radiants in the tower for a reason. Anti-Stormlight will need subjects for testing."
"You can't be implying," Navani said. "You don't mean..."
"Today is a momentous day," Raboniel said, letting go and walking after the servants carrying Navani's equipment. "Today is the day we discovered a way to destroy Radiant Spren. I will let you know the results of the test."
The end of part 4. Interludes. Hesina, Aiden, Teravangian.
Interlude 10. Hesina. Hesina made a small notation in her notebook, kneeling above a map she'd rolled out on the floor. The cache Relaine had brought included 5 maps of Alethkar, focused on different princedoms. Sadius's was included, with notes about Singer troop placements in certain cities, and whatever else the scouts had seen while doing reconnaissance of the area. It had taken her until now to realize she could check on Tomat. The city had several long paragraphs of attached observations, written by Kara, the Windrunner. The Singers had the city wall under repair, which was incredible on its own. That had been broken since, what, her grandfather's days? The infamous gap would be gone if she ever visited again. She couldn't find specifics about the people who had lived in the city, but that wasn't surprising. The Windrunners hadn't been able to get too close, after all. At least there were no reports of burnt-out houses, as in some other cities. It seemed the city had given in without too much of a fight, which boded well for local survival rates. She wrote each detail in her notebook, then glanced up as Liren slipped into their sectioned-off surgery chamber. He let the draped sheets fall closed, fabric rustling. He'd been studying the large model of Urethiru that was at the back of the infirmary room. "You found Tomat?" he asked, adjusting his spectacles and leaning down beside her. "Huh, anything useful?"
"Not much," she said. "Similar notes to other cities."
"Well, we'd probably know if your father died," Liren said, straightening to gather some bandages from the counter.
"And how is that?"
"He'd be haunting me, obviously," Liren said. "Living as a shade in the storms, calling for my blood. As I haven't heard a thing, I must assume the old monster is alive."
Hesina rolled up the map and gave her husband a flat glare, which he accepted with a smile and a twinkle to his eye.
"It's been 25 years, Hesina said. "He might have softened toward you by now."
"Stone doesn't soften with time, dear," Liren replied. "It merely grows brittle. I think we'd sooner see a chull fly than see your father grow soft."
He must have noticed that the topic legitimately worried her, because he turned away from the jibes.
"I'd bet that he's fine, Hesina. Some men are too ornery to be bothered by something as mundane as an invasion."
"He wouldn't give up his business easily, Liren. He's stubborn as a light eyes. He'd order his guards to fight, even when everyone else had surrendered."
Liren returned to his work and, after a short delay, said,
"I'm sure he's fine."
"You are thinking that if he lifted a sword," Hesina said, "he deserved whatever he got."
and her father would use a sword. Under a special writ of forbearance from the city lord, who, even 3 decades ago, had been accustomed to doing whatever her father bullied him into doing, she'd met only one man who dared defy him.
"I'm thinking," Liren said, "that my wife needs a supportive husband, not a self-righteous one."
"And our son?" she asked. "Which version of you does he deserve?" Liren stiffened, bandages held in front of him. She turned away, trying to contain her emotions. She hadn't planned to snap at him, but, well, she supposed she hadn't forgiven him for driving Kaladin away. Liren quietly stepped over, then settled down on the floor beside her, pushing aside the bandages. Then he held up his hands.
"What do you want of me, Hesina? Do you want me to abandon my convictions?"
"I want you," she said, "to appreciate your incredible son."
"He was supposed to be better than this. He was supposed to be better than I am."
"Liren," she said softly, "you can't keep blaming yourself for Tien's death."
"Would he be dead if I hadn't spent all those years defying Roshon? If I hadn't picked a fight?"
"We can't change the past. But if you continue like this, you'll lose another son." He looked up, then shifted his eyes away immediately at Tessina's cold glare.
"I wouldn't have let him die," Liren said. "If they hadn't decided to go get that edge dancer, I'd have gone to Kaladin like they asked."
"I know that. But would you have insisted on bringing him here?"
"Maybe. He could have needed extended care, Hesina. Isn't it better to bring him here, where I can watch him? Better than letting him go on fighting an impossible battle, getting himself and others killed in this foolish war."
"And would you have done that to another soldier?" she pressed. "Say it wasn't your son who was wounded. Would you have brought that boy here and risked him being imprisoned? Maybe executed? You've healed soldiers before, sending them back out to fight. That's always been your conviction. Treat anyone, no strings attached, no matter the circumstances."
"Maybe I need to rethink that policy," he said. "Besides, Kaladin has told me many times that he's not my son any longer."
"Great. I'm glad we could chat, so I could persuade you to be more stubborn. I see that your thoughts and feelings are evolving on this topic, and because you're you, they're going the absolute wrong direction."
Liren sighed. He stood and grabbed the stack of bandages, then turned to leave their little draped-off chamber.
"Storm it? She wasn't done with him yet." Hesina rose, surprised at the depth of her frustration.
"Don't you leave," she snapped, causing him to stop by the drapes.
"Hesina," he said, sounding tired.
"What do you want from me?"
She stalked over to him, pointing. "I left everything for you, Liren. Do you know why?"
"Because you believed in me?"
"Because I loved you. And I still love you."
"Love can't change the realities of our situation."
"No, but it can change people." She seized his hand, less a comforting gesture and more a demand that he remain there with her so they could face this together. "I know how stressed you feel. I feel it too. Feel like I'm going to get crushed by it. But I'm not going to let you continue to pretend Kaladin isn't your son."
"The son I raised would never have committed murder in my surgery room."
"Your son is a soldier, Liren. A soldier who inherited his father's determination, skill, and compassion. You tell me honestly, who would you rather have out there fighting? Some crazed killer who enjoys it? Or the boy you trained to care?"
He hesitated, then opened his mouth.
"Before you say you don't want anyone fighting," Hesina interrupted, "know that I'll recognize that
as a lie. We both know you've admitted that people need to fight sometimes. You simply don't want it to be your son, despite the fact that he's probably the best person we could have chosen.
You obviously know the responses you want from me, Liren said. So why should I bother speaking?
Hesina groaned, tipping her head back.
You can be so storming frustrating.
In return, he squeezed her hand gently.
I'm sorry, he said, his voice softer. I'll try to listen better, Hesina, I promise.
Don't just listen better, she said, pulling him out of the draped-off section and waving toward the larger room.
See better. Look. What do you see?
The place was busy with humans who wanted to care for the Radiance. Hesina had instituted a rotation so that everyone got a chance. Beneath the gaze of two watching Stormform Regals, people of all ethnicities and wearing all kinds of clothing moved among the comatose Radiance, administering water, changing sheets, brushing hair. Hesina and Liren used a more carefully cultivated group, mostly Ardents, to handle delicate matters like bathing the patients. But today's caregivers were common inhabitants of the tower. Dark eyes made up the majority of these, but each and every one wore a shash glyph like Kaladin's painted on their forehead.
What do you see? Hesina whispered again to Liren. Honestly? He asked. Yes. I see fools, he said, refusing to accept the truth, resisting when they'll just get crushed.
She heard the words he left off.
Like I was.
She towed him by his arm to one side of the room, where a man with only one arm sat on a stool, painting the glyph on a young girl's head. She ran off to her duty as Liren and Hesina arrived. The man stood respectfully. Bearded, wearing a buttoned shirt and trousers, he had three moles on his cheek. He nodded to Hesina and Liren, almost a bow, as far as he could go without provoking a reaction from the watching fused, who didn't like such signs of respect shown to other humans.
I know you, Liren said,
narrowing his eyes at the man.
You're one of the refugees who came to Hearthstone.
I'm Norrell, sir,
the man said.
You sent me to the Ardents on suicide watch. Thank you for trying to help.
Well, Liren said, you seem to be doing better.
Depends on the day, sir, Norrell said. But I'd say I'm better than I was when you met me.
Liren glanced at Hesina, who squeezed his hand and gestured her chin toward Norrell's forehead and the glyph.
Why do you wear that glyph? Liren asked. To honor Stormblast, who still fights.
Norrell nodded as if to himself. I'll be ready when he calls for me, sir.
Don't you see the irony in that? Liren asked. It was fighting in your homeland that made you flee and therefore get into all the trouble you've faced. Fighting lost you everything. If people would stop with this nonsense, I would have to see far fewer men with battle shock like yours.
Norrell settled down on his stool and used his hand to stir his cup of black paint, which he placed between his knees.
Suppose you're right, sir. Can't argue with a surgeon about the nonsense we do. But, sir, do you know why I get up each day?
Liren shook his head.
It's hard, sometimes, Norrell said, stirring. Coming awake means leaving the nothingness, you know? Remembering the pain. But then I think, well, he gets up. You mean Kaladin?
Liren asked.
Yes, sir, Norrell said. He's got the emptiness, bad as I do. I can see it in him. We all can, but he gets up anyway.
We're trapped in here, and we all want to do something to help. We can't, but somehow he can. And you know, I've listened to Ardent's talk. I've been poked and prodded. I've been stuck in the dark. None of that worked as well as knowing this one thing, sir. He still gets up. He still fights. So I figure I can too.
Hesina squeezed Lirin's hand again, pulling him away as she thanked Norrell with a smile.
You want me to acknowledge, Lirin whispered, that what Kaladin's doing is helping that man, while my surgeon's treatments could have done nothing.
You said you'd listen, she said. You asked what I want of you? I want you to talk to them, Lirin, the people in this room. Don't challenge them. Don't argue with them. Simply ask them why they wear that glyph. And see them, Lirin. Please.
She left him standing there and returned to her maps, trusting in him and the man she knew he was.
Interlude 11. Aiden. Aiden was going to be a windrunner someday. He had it all figured out. Yes, he was just a potter's son and spent his days learning how to turn creme into plates, but the High Marshal himself had once been a dark-eyed boy from an unknown village. The Spren didn't just pick kings and queens. They watched everyone looking for warriors. So, as he followed his father through the halls of Urethiru, Aiden found opportunities to glare at the invaders. Many might have said that at 13 he was too young to become a Radiant, but he knew for a fact there was a girl who had been chosen when she was younger than him. He had seen her leaving food out for old Gavam, the widow who sometimes forgot to collect her rations. You had to be brave, even when you thought nobody was watching. That was what the Spren wanted. They didn't care how old you were, if your eyes were dark, or if the bowls you made were lopsided. They wanted you to be brave. Glaring at singers wasn't much. He knew he could and would have to do more, when the time was right. And he couldn't let the enemy catch him being unruly. So for now, he stepped to the side of the corridor with his father and let the large group of warforms pass. He dutifully stood there, his father's hand on his shoulder, their heads bowed. But as soon as the warforms had passed, Aiden looked up, and he glared after them, angry as he could be. He wasn't the only one. He caught Shar, the seamstress's daughter, glaring too. Well, her uncle was a windrunner, so maybe she figured she had a better chance than most, but surely the Spren were more discerning than that. Shar was so bossy you'd think she was light-eyed.
Doesn't matter, Aiden reminded himself. The Spren don't care if you're bossy. They just want you to be brave.
Well, he could handle a little competition from Shar, and when he got his Spren first, maybe he could give her a few tips. Aiden's father caught him glaring, unfortunately, and squeezed his shoulder.
Eyes down, he hissed.
Aiden obeyed reluctantly as another group of soldiers marched past, all heading for the atrium. Had there been some kind of disturbance? Aiden had better not have missed another appearance by Stormblast. He couldn't believe he'd spent the last fight napping. He hoped the Spren would look at people's parents when choosing their Radiance, because Aiden's father was extremely brave. Oh, he didn't glare at passing soldiers, but he didn't need to. Aiden's father spent many afternoons tending the fallen Radiants, directly beneath the gaze of the Fused, and every night he went out in secret, doing something. Once the soldiers passed, everyone else continued on their way. Aiden's ankle hurt a little, but it mostly felt better from when he'd hurt it, so he didn't even limp anymore. He didn't want a Spren to see him acting weak. What was going on? He went up on his toes, trying to look over the crowd, but his father didn't let him linger. Together, they entered the market, then turned toward Master Ligonor's shop. It felt strange to keep following their normal routine.
How could they continue making pottery at a time like this? How could Master Ligonor open the shop for business like nothing was happening? Well, that was part of their bravery. Aiden had figured it out. They entered the back of the shop and set up in the workroom. Aiden got busy, knowing that they had to act normal so the enemy wouldn't figure out something was up. You had to get them to feel secure, comfortable. Today, Aiden did that by heaving out his bucket of creme, pouring off the water on top and mixing it until it was a paste. Then he mashed it for his father until it was just the right consistency, a little more squishy than dough. He worked the lump aggressively, showing those Spren, who were undoubtedly watching him by now, that he had good strong arms. Windrunners needed strong arms because they didn't use their legs much on account of them flying around everywhere. As he worked the creme, his arms starting to burn, the earthy scent of wet rock filling the air, he heard the front door shut. Master Ligonor had arrived. The old man was nice for a light eyes. Once upon a time, he had done all the glaze work on the pottery himself, but now it was all completed by Gub, the other journeyman besides Aiden's father. Aiden mashed the creme to the proper consistency, then handed a chunk to his father, who had been cleaning and setting the wheel. Aiden's father hefted it, pushed one finger in, then nodded approvingly. "Make another batch," he said, putting the chunk onto his wheel. "We'll practice your plates." "I won't need to be able to make plates once I can fly," Aiden said. "And what if it takes you until your 20s to become a windrunner?" his father asked. "You'll need to do something with your time until then. Might as well make plates."
"Spren don't care about plates."
"They must," his father said, spinning up the wheel by pumping his foot on the pedal. "Their radiants have to eat, after all." He started shaping the creme. "Never underestimate the value of a job well done, Aiden. You want a Spren to notice you? Take pride in every job you do. Men who make sloppy plates will be sloppy fighting fused." Aiden narrowed his eyes. How did his father know that? Was it merely another piece of wisdom drawn from his never-ending well of fatherly quips, or was it from personal experience? Regardless, Aiden dragged out another bucket of creme. They were running low. Where would they get more now that traders weren't coming in from the plains? He was halfway through mixing the new batch when Master Ligonor entered, wringing his hands. Short, bald, and tubby, he looked like a vase, the kind that had been made with too short a neck to really be useful. But he was nice.
"Something's happening, Alalan," the master said. "Something in the atrium. I don't like it. I think I'll close the shop today, just in case."
Aiden's father nodded calmly, still shaping his current pot. When he was on a pot, nothing could shake him. He kept sculpting, wetting his fingers absently.
"What do you think?" Master Ligonor asked.
"A good idea," Aiden's father replied. "Put out the glyph for lunch and maybe we can reopen later."
"Good, good,"
the master said, bustling out of the workshop into the attached showroom.
I think I'll head to my room for a while. You'll keep working? We're low on water pots, as always."
Master Ligonor closed and latched the wooden windows at the front of the small shop, then locked the door. Then he went upstairs to his rooms. As soon as he was gone, Aiden's father stood up, leaving a pot half-finished on the wheel. "Watch the shop, son," he said, washing his hands, then walked toward the back door. Short, with curly hair and a quiet way about him, he was not the type someone would pick out of a crowd as a hero. Yet Aiden knew exactly where he was going. Aiden stood up, hands coated in creme.
"You're going to go see what's happening, aren't you? In the atrium?"
His father hesitated, his hand on the doorknob. "Stay here and watch the shop."
"You're going to paint your head with the glyph," Aiden said, "and go watch over the radiance. Just in case, I want to go with you."
"Your ankle
is fine now," Aiden said. "If something does go wrong, you'll need me to run home and tell Mother. Plus, if there's trouble, there could be looting here in the market. I'll be safer with you."
Aiden's father debated, then sighed and waved him forward. Aiden felt his heart thundering in his chest as he hurried to obey. He could feel it, an energy in the air. It would happen today. Today, he'd pick up a spear and earn his spren. Interlude 12. Vulnerable. Taravangian had given up on being smart. It seemed that the longer he lived, the less his intelligence varied each day. And when it did vary, it seemed to move steadily downward, towards stupidity, towards sentimentality. His smart days lately would have been average just months ago. He needed to act anyway. He could not afford to wait upon intelligence. The world could not afford to wait upon the whims of his situation. Unfortunately, Taravangian had no idea how to proceed. He'd failed to recruit Zeth. Taravangian was too stupid to manipulate that man now. He'd started a dozen letters to Dalinar and ripped them all up. The right words. Dalinar would only respond to the right words. Plus, whatever Taravangian wrote seemed too much a risk to Carbranth. He couldn't sacrifice his home. He couldn't. Worse, each day he found time slipping away faster and faster. He'd wake from a nap in his chair and the entire day had passed. Usually it was the pain that woke him. He wasn't simply old. He wasn't simply feeble. This was worse. Today, Taravangian forced himself to move to keep from drifting off again. He hobbled through his prison of a house, trying so hard to think. There had to be a solution. Go to Dalinar, a part of him urged. Don't write him, talk to him. Was Taravangian actually waiting on the right words, or was there another reason he delayed? A willing disregard for the truth. The slightly smarter version of him didn't want to give this up to the Blackthorn. He shuffled toward the small bathroom on the main floor, leafing through his notebook, looking over hundreds of crossed-out notes and ideas. The answer was here. He felt it. It was so frustrating, knowing how smart he could be, yet living below that capacity so much of the time. Other people didn't understand intelligence and stupidity. They assumed people who were stupid were somehow less human, less capable of making decisions or plans. That wasn't it at all. He could plan, he merely needed time. He could remember things, given a chance to drill them into his brain. Part of being smart, in his experience, was about speed more than capacity. That and the ability to memorize. When he'd created problems to test his daily intelligence, they had taken these dynamics into account, measuring how quickly he could do problems and how well he could remember the equations and principles needed to do so. He had none of that ability now, but he needed none of it. The answer was here in the notebook. He settled down on the stool in his bathroom, too tired to move the seat elsewhere, as he flipped through the pages. Taravangian had a huge advantage over almost everyone else. Others, stupid or smart, tended to overestimate their abilities. Not Taravangian. He knew exactly how it felt to be both smart and stupid. He could use that. He had to. He needed to use every advantage he had. He had to create a plan as daring as the diagram and do so without the gifts cultivation had given him. The plan of a man, not a god. He racked his brain for anything in the diagram relating to Nightblood, the sword. But there was nothing. They hadn't anticipated the sword. Still, he had been given a report by agents he'd sent to research it, by interviewing one of its former bearers. Taravangian pulled tidbits from that report from the recesses of his mind, then wrote them on a fresh page of his notebook. The sword feeds on the essence that makes up all things, he wrote, scribbling by the light of a single ruby sphere. It will draw out stormlight eagerly, feasting, but if there is no stormlight, it will feed on one's own soul. The agent had noted that Nightblood worked like a larkin, the beasts that could feed on investiture. What else did he know? What other clues could he give himself? "Odium has greatly expanded intelligence," he wrote. "He can be in many places at once and can command the elements. But he feels the same way a man does. He can be tricked, and he seems to have a central self, a core person." Zeth had refused to listen to Taravangian. However, the man had come when Taravangian seeded the proper incentive out into the world, so maybe he didn't need to make Zeth do anything other than arrive in the same place as Odium. The Shin Assassin was reckless and unstable. Surely Zeth would strike out against Odium if he saw the god manifesting. But how? How can I possibly make the timing work? Taravangian sighed, his head thumping with pain. He looked across at the small hand mirror he'd set up on the counter. The ruby sphere he was using for light reflected in the mirror. But his face did not reflect. Instead, he saw a shadowy figure, female, with long flowing black hair. The entire figure was a shadow, the eyes like white holes into nothingness. Taravangian blinked very slowly, then began to tremble with fear. Storms. Storms. He attempted to gather his wits and control his emotions. He probably would have run to hide if he had the strength. In this case, his weakening body served him as it forced him to sit there until he could control himself.
Hello, Ja'anat, he finally managed to say. I had not realized any of the unmade were here. What is wrong with you?
A voice said in his mind, warped and distorted, like a dozen voices overlapping.
What has happened to you? This is how I am sometimes. It is the Night Watcher's fault. No, the other one, the god. She touched three that I know, the child, the general, and you. The old magic, the Night Watcher. I begin to wonder if it was all a cover these many centuries, a way for her to secretly bring in people she wanted to touch. She has been playing a far more subtle game than Odium realized. Why did you go to her? What did you ask? For the capacity to stop what was coming, he said.
He was too frightened to lie. Even the smart him hadn't wanted to face one of these things.
She sows many seeds, Ja'anat said. Can you do it? Can you stop what is coming?
I don't know,
Taravangian whispered.
Can it be stopped? Can he be stopped?
I am uncertain. The power behind him is strong, but his mind is exposed. The mind and the power seek different goals. This leaves him not weak, but vulnerable.
I have wondered,
Taravangian said, glancing down at his notebook,
if he is merely playing with me. I assume he looks over my shoulder at everything I write.
No, he is not everywhere. His power is, but he is not. There are limits, and his void spren eyes fear coming too close to a bondsmith.
Something itched at Taravangian through the fear and confusion. Ja'anat. She spoke like she wanted Odium to fall. Wasn't there something in the diagram about this? He tried to remember. Storms. Was she tricking him into confessing? Should he stay quiet and not say anything? No, he had to try.
I need a way to lure Odium to me, Taravangian said. At the right time.
I will arrange for you to be given gemstones with two of my children inside, she said. Odium searches for them. He watches me, certain I will make a mistake and reveal my true intentions. We are connected, so my children appearing will draw his attention. Good luck, human, when he does come. You are not protected from him, as many on this world are. You have made deals that exempt you from such safety.
She faded from the mirror, and Taravangian hunched over, trembling as he continued to write. Part 5. Knowing a Home of Songs, Called Our Burden. The Knights Radiant, Navani, Bridge 4, Taravangian, Vire, Lesion, Wit. 98. An Unwholesome Shade.
I look forward to ruling the humans.
Musings of L on the first of the final.